Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 729, Interview with Daniel Hopsicker, Strange Doings South of the Border. This program is being recorded on November 27th of the year 2010. Once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airwaves Daniel Hopsicker, the heroic investigative reporter who is the kingpin of the Mad Cow Morning News, the madcowprod.com website, and also the author of, first of all, welcome to Terrorland, now out in paperback, also Barry and the Boys, sadly not out in paperback, and also the editor-producer of The New American Drug Lords, a video which I think complements his many investigative pieces superbly. Daniel, welcome back to our airwaves.
Good to be with you, Dave.
Well, you have been characteristically cranking it out there, and one of the focal points of your research over the decades has been some of the intelligence community / CIA drug traffic. I don't like to pin it specifically to CIA. Certainly the CIA was involved, but I think the intelligence community drug traffic is much larger than that. And indeed, one of the things that is now taking place and that really constitutes some of the very strange fandango you've been talking about, and that concerns the extent to which many of these clandestine drug intelligence operations, obviously in which elements of the federal intelligence apparatus and allied institutions are bringing illegal drugs into the country in a big way, and some of these networks are intersecting for whatever reason or reasons. Countries that are not only opposed to the United States, but in some cases, elements that are overt enemies of the United States. Hence, the strange doings south of the border. And you've been coming across some really strange bedfellows. Daniel, you did a piece dated November 18th about a really strange fellow, a Syrian-born, ostensibly Venezuelan-based drug trafficker with a name that I just love, Waleed Makhled Garcia. Why don't you fill us in a little bit about Mr. Garcia and some of the many strange shores upon which he has trod over the years?
Well, he's a Syrian, first of all. He's Lebanese, you know, from the area of Lebanon. Most Lebanese sometimes claim to be Syrians as well.
Yeah, but we should mention that actually Lebanon was a part of Syria until just after, I think it was World War I, when the French kind of snapped off part of the old Ottoman Empire and appropriated that for themselves. Go ahead.
And the DEA is claiming that he is one of the two or three biggest drug kingpins in the world.
Excuse me for butting in again, but one of the two or three biggest drug that would put him way up there. I mean, that's quite a statement.
They're also claiming that he is the kingpin behind the famous, by now famous, DC-9 with 5.5 tons of cocaine on board.
Mm-hmm.
In their press release, announces indictment of one of the world's most significant narcotics kingpins. So and then they go on to call him one of the two or three biggest. And yet, when you read the hyperbole in the press release, but when you read the indictment and when you read the affidavit that goes with it, it doesn't quite measure up to what they're claiming. The whole point behind Waleed Makhled is that he was a crony of Hugo Chavez's.
And Hugo Chavez, of course, the president of Venezuela, is ranged on the opposite side of the political court from the United States, at least at the moment.
Correct. And when he was caught, but he had a falling out with Chavez. We know that for a fact. We don't know exactly what the cause of it was. He and his family own a major shipping company in Venezuela, and they controlled the biggest port in Venezuela until a few years ago, 2-3 years ago, 2005, when the Venezuelan police raided their ranch out in the outback and discovered 300 kilos of cocaine. And his two brothers have been imprisoned since then, apparently, and he went on the run. and moved to Colombia.
Now, the he again being Waleed McLeod Garcia.
Waleed McLeod, yeah.
Go ahead.
And then he was caught in August in Colombia, okay? Now, the DEA began to salivate because they want him here in the U.S. because as soon as he was caught, he started to talk, okay, which is what I would do if I was facing life in prison, and began claiming, and I'm sure with complete truthfulness, that he had bribed 15 top Venezuelan generals, as well as a multi-payment of $1 million to the head of the Venezuelan DEA, for lack of a better word, and that he had contributed $2 million directly to Hugo Chavez in the referendum campaign on him a few years ago. So the DEA and the U.S. attorney in Manhattan released an indictment in a press release, and he's kind of, if I can say this, he's kind of the DEA's wet dream. They're accusing him of being in league with Hugo Chavez and of selling cocaine from the FARC, the insurgency in Colombia.
Now, the FARC are the left-wing guerrillas in Colombia, because the Colombian narco scene is a complicated one because both sides, both the right-wing paramilitary elements and the FARC left-wing paramilitary elements, both finance themselves with the cocaine trade to a considerable extent. Go ahead, Daniel.
But everybody does. Okay, that's in 2001, the last time this thing was looked at impartially. The FARC was responsible for 2% of the cocaine coming out of Colombia, which means someone else was responsible for 90%, 98%, and that's the government around Alvaro Uribe and the associated paramilitary, right wing paramilitaries.
Mm-hmm.
So it is exactly the same situation that existed with Pablo Escobar. And with Barry Seal, when Barry Seal, when Pablo Escobar was, they were talking about the Medellin cartel being the, it was supplying, I guess they said 70-80% of the cocaine coming into the U.S. It was not that way. It was they were the minor league players with maybe 20-30% in the Cali cartel, which no one in the U.S. mentioned because they were the officially protected. Cartel was supplying 70%. So they flip things around anytime it suits their purpose and tell basically bald-faced lies. And there's a DEA initiative right now that is based on two, from what I can tell, bald-faced lies. One is that Waleed McLeod is one of the two or three biggest drug kingpins in the world, which is certainly not an assertion that that they back up with any facts in their affidavit or indictment. And two, that Waleed McLeod, the basic assertion is that there is a pipeline stretching from Hugo Chavez in South America to Al Qaeda in Iraq, pumping cocaine, and the Al Qaeda in Africa.
Yeah, okay. I was going to say they had the right string, wrong yo-yo. Go ahead.
Right now, because I've been following this one story, the 5.5 tons of cocaine story, for 4 years, I know stuff that nobody else except the DEA knows. Certainly, reporters don't know it about the truth of the these essential assertions. And they don't stand up. I mean, they don't stand up in a kind of spectacular way. Beginning in January of this year, you began to see headlines about Al Qaeda in Africa moving into the drug trade and sending cocaine to Europe from there, like they were to the pipeline from South America across the Atlantic to Guinea-Bissau, for example. And they cited two examples One was a Boeing 727 that was found burning in the middle of the Sahara Desert, and I mean in the middle of the Sahara Desert, hundreds of miles from nowhere. And they said that had 10 tons of cocaine on board. And the second incident that they cited as evidence that Al-Qaeda was moving into the drug trade in Africa was the bust of a Gulfstream in Guinea-Bissau in 2008 with half a ton of cocaine on board. Well, the curious thing was that incident was major in Mexico for the following reason. When that incident happened, the Mexican press learned that the pilot of the 5.5 tons of cocaine DC-9 flight in 2006 was no longer in jail in Mexico. You would think, because he was caught at sometime after April 2006, he was caught and put in jail. And then the next thing the Mexican press learns is 2 years later, he's been busted in Guinea-Bissau. That was their first inkling that something might not be kosher, and a reporter who follows the drug trade for a major Mexican city newspaper learned that there were six major narcotics traffickers, this pilot among them, who were no longer in jail, and who the attorney general in Mexico had no interest in commenting on why they were no longer in jail. So when I found this, I wrote a story, and I compared Mexico's narcotics policy down there to catch and release. I mean, it's like a fisherman. It's they're catching these guys and letting them go, and you go, well, what's up with that? Well, if this guy, Carmelo Vasquez Guerra, let's follow this just for a minute, the pilot of the 5.5 tons of cocaine flight, was released from jail in Mexico, it certainly wouldn't have been because of the intervention of Hugo Chavez.
Of course not. Right. Go ahead. I mean, forgive the chuckle. Yes.
Unless things are totally topsy-turvy and we have absolutely no idea what's going on, it appears, you know, that Felipe Calderon and George Bush were and Navarro Uribe were a solid front, you know, against the enemies of the state. So, right there you go, well, you know, Waleed Maclid certainly wasn't responsible for this pilot getting out of jail, and this pilot is being tied to Hugo Chavez and to Al-Qaeda in Africa, in Guinea-Bissau, you know, something about that just doesn't parse, okay? Especially when you realize that they have already tied the DEA and Mexican officials, the 5.5-ton plane busted with another plane that went down 18 months later in the Yucatan with 4 tons of cocaine, a Gulfstream, which used to be a CIA plane. Both of those planes were purchased through the same mechanism in Mexico. They're already on record as saying. So here's a CIA plane, or ex-CIA plane, you know, X in quotes, busted with 4 tons of cocaine. I don't imagine that plane had anything to do with an organization sending cocaine to Al-Qaeda in Africa. It just, something about that doesn't seem right at all. So anyway, this pilot, Carmelo Vasquez, gets busted in Guinea-Bissau, and then he gets released. And the half a ton of cocaine disappears. And the pilot slips across the border to Mali, and he gets busted there a week later and mysteriously is released again. So he's been busted 3 times and released 3 times. All of these nations where he's been busted and released are supposedly allied with the U.S. and don't have anything to do with Al-Qaeda in Africa. The plane that he was busted on, and this, you know, now we begin to touch on what's really going on. Okay, what has happened over the past half a dozen years since word of CIA extraordinary renditions has you know reached mass consciousness is a phenomenon known as plane spotters has arisen, you know, seemingly spontaneously around the world, where people that are a bit outraged at the idea that the major intelligence service in the Western world has been flying people around willy-nilly, go out to airports and they write down the registration numbers on the planes that fly in, and then they run them later. And they've learned an extraordinary amount through that. Also, the other major phenomenon that's going on that I can speak to personally is that because of the internet, I can now read through the good offices of Google. I can now read newspapers in other countries that I couldn't before. I don't speak Spanish. I now have instant access to the Latin American press. Surprisingly, the Latin American press is a lot more free than we are. You can pick up any newspaper in Mexico City and read the names of the Mexican drug lords, read who's up and who's down, who's in favor with the current Mexican president and who's not. You can't do that here. Well, of course, the DEA says we have no American drug lords. And the reason we have no American drug lords is because they're not interested in pursuing them. The American owners of the plane busted with 5.5 tons of cocaine walk around free today, and I'm sure they're not losing any sleep over being arrested anytime soon. And you know, when you follow it, it extends all the way to the indictment of Waleed Maclet. I'm reading the indictment, and they're accusing Waleed Maclet. I have no doubt that this is true. They're accusing him of being responsible for bribing being responsible for bribing officials at an airport in Venezuela that was used to transship cocaine north. Okay, I have absolutely no doubt that that's true. But they talk about the unindicted co-conspirators who own the plane and the unindicted co-conspirators who own the cocaine, and these folks are unindicted and unidentified and not about to suffer consequences anytime soon. And you just have to throw your hands up and go, you know, it's clear what's going on. Waleed Maclet Garcia is the kingpin du jour, the same way that Pablo Escobar was. Now, when Pablo Escobar and the Medellin cartel got brought down, there was absolutely no interruption in the flow of cocaine to the U.S. There was absolutely no change in price. There was absolutely no change in purity. And if you were paying attention at the time, you began to realize that when the DEA announces, or especially the Coast Guard, you know, announces the bust of a ship with 35 tons of cocaine or whatever, they have not removed 35 tons of cocaine from the streets of America. All they've done is remove 35 tons of somebody else's cocaine. And so we're paying for a drug war that $40 billion a year, apparently, for the drug war, not to stop the flow of narcotics into the U.S., but to stop the flow of non-approved narcotics into the U.S.
Mm-hmm. No question about it. And by the way, Daniel, I want to put in a plug for your New American Drug Lords video. I want to thank you for the gratis copy you sent me, and I want to recommend it very emphatically to members of the audience. Those members of the audience who have been following the coverage of Daniel's investigation of some of these networks over the years, I think will have your understanding enhanced simply because the nature of the articles in the investigation itself is episodic, and again, over a period of years, so the continuity and the institutional flow, so to speak, to coin a term, I think is much more effectively presented in the video because it's a unified entity that proceeds from one point of investigation to another than the episodic presentation of that same material, basically, in many of your articles. It's not to find fault with your articles, but I think those listeners who have followed the articles and who occasionally find their name, their eyes crossing as they attempt to keep track of the nomenclature, would do more than well to get a hold of your New American Drug Lords video, and we'll promote the website at the end of this side because it helps to clarify, I think, how many of these connections fit together.
All I've been doing is following basically this one story. And the reason I've been following this one story about the 5.5 tons of cocaine is because the people that own the plane used an address at the Venice airport right next to Huffman Aviation. And I already knew that the owner of Huffman Aviation had a plane busted with 43 pounds of heroin 3 weeks after Muhammad Atta arrived at his flight school. So, you know, if you had a prosecuting attorney worth his salt, or district attorney like Jim Garrison, you know, anyone with any brains would begin to make inferences and look for connections, and then it begins to fall into place. It begins to fall into place that there are American drug lords, that they do supply the narcotics that do come into the U.S., and that, moreover, that the 2 million Americans who have been imprisoned for selling small amounts of what these folks are bringing in by the ton would have a valid reason for complaining that they're being selectively prosecuted. All of this costs the U.S. an enormous amount of money. It costs taxpayers an enormous amount of money. It doesn't necessarily cost the people that control us anything. And the way I likened it in the documentary to this, you know, imagine a situation where the chairman of Coca-Cola every year was able to announce to his stockholders not just the money that they made selling Coke, but also to announce that he was being given $40 billion by the government every year to prevent Pepsi from selling its products. That's the situation we've got here in the U.S.
And Pepsi-Cola was very, very close to Richard Nixon and some of the elements that also, yeah, it's an interesting.
Probably could have come up with a less elusive. Yeah, and then the Pepsi-Cola plant in where was it, Laos or Thailand?
It was a Pepsi plant that was a heroin refinery. It was right. The largest heroin refinery in Asia. It was a Pepsi plant that was established and financed in part by U.S. government monies, lobbied for by then Attorney Richard Nixon. And more than a little interesting under the circumstances. By the way, Pepsi-Cola, there's a good book. People want to read about the power politics of the colas. There's a good book called The Cola Wars. And looming large in the power politics of the colas are the power politics of sugar. And that brings us once again back to the world of covert ops and the world of Cuba, Castro, 11-22-63, and some of the things that lie at the foundation of the networks that have evolved over the decades, really more than a half a century, into the Huffman milieu that you've been investigating since September 11th.
Well, that's exactly right, isn't it? I mean, when September 11th happened, Dave, if I can be allowed a personal aside, I'm of an age and of a generation where I have found myself on the wrong side, or not the wrong side, but on the minority side of every major thing that's happened in this country since I was in seventh grade and Kennedy was killed. And after when 9/11 happened, I thought, well, at least I am now on the same side as everybody else in the country. I was interested in tracking down and bringing to justice anyone who had anything to do with it, including any Americans who had happened to have anything to do with the presence in this country and the protection in this country of the people who had been alleged to have been involved in the attacks. And then when I began to find out that they weren't being pursued, once again, I mean, I was on the outside looking in, because there are Americans who are very much alive who are responsible for Muhammad Atta being able to strut around on runways in Miami, for instance, where he left a plane and stalked off. I mean, with no consequences, no consequences at all. So, alas, we live. I mean, and you know, you've known this for a long time. I mean, the powers that be, we say the CIA, it's shorthand, made a determination. And probably a correct one, back maybe as early as World War II, but certainly soon thereafter, that control of illegal narcotics was going to be a geostrategic key to their ends. And everything that's happened since then is, you know, furthers that purpose. The airport in Venice, Florida, was probably, I mean, the first reference to narcotics at the tiny airport in Venice, Florida, I found was in 1938.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, people busted with heroin. During World War II, the Venice, Florida airport was used to train pilots for the Flying Tigers.
Right.
General Claire Chennault. And that's the entity or the grouping that became responsible for, and all in the name, you know, don't you know, of anti-communism, we allowed Chiang Kai-shek to sell heroin in the U.S. to support his nationalist cause.
And you know what else, Daniel? It is part of the anti-communist crusade in Asia, too. A lot of the Asian heroin trade was actually overseen by Japanese fascists who had fought against the U.S. in World War II and then jumped, like so many of the various fascist combatants did, to the, quote, Allied side in order to pursue the Cold War. But a lot of that came from Japan. And the kingpins there, the Asian drug lords, were Japanese who actually collaborated with many of the fascist Chinese in that same traffic. So ours is not the only country that has seen controlling narcotics as a powerful, effective tool of not only covert operations but simply political repression, although obviously major elements in our power elite, in turn directing intelligence services, have obviously undertaken a similar program.
Well, you know, and that's exactly right. And the way I likened it to myself when I first became aware of it and began to explore its ramifications is this. You know, you and I both live in a small town in the Midwest, and we both want to be the mayor. And I own a hardware store, and you own a sporting goods store, and they both make about the same amount of money. But then I ally myself with people that are also selling heroin and cocaine in town. And all of a sudden, I've got enough money to, like, you know, put up billboards all over town. It's an unfair advantage to be allied with the people that control the drug trade, you know, if you're talking about a supposedly, you know, free democracy, because the amounts of money that it kicks off are ungodly.
Mm-hmm.
Ungodly.
Absolutely. Daniel, we are almost out of time on this side. I, earlier in this side, promoted the New American Drug Lords. That is among the things that can be found at www.madcowprod.com. Tell us what else they can find there, Daniel.
Stories going back, you know, a dozen years, an archive, and links to clips from all of my shows, and, you know, my various other paraphernalia, books, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't managed to, like, get cheap keychains or coffee mugs on the site.
What I want little fuzzy figures for keychains. You know, that's what I want. The little fuzzy figures, anyway, with green hair and
Angora on the end.
And cute.
Yeah,
cute.
Exactly.
It's got to be cute. Daniel, we are all out of time on this side. We're going to resume this thread of discussion in Side 2. This concludes Side 1. For the record, program number 729, interview with Daniel Hopsicker, Strange Doings South of the Border. This program is being recorded on November 27th of the year 2010. For Daniel Hopsicker, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.